Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or now you can download our podcast on iTunes.
Speaking of our podcast, I think we should mention that Time Out New York wrote a piece on the best podcasts for food around, and they picked four, and we were one of them.
Yes, we were actually the first one mentioned.
Which was really great.
Very pleasant.
Especially for the 10,000 people who then clicked onto our website and downloaded our show. My web administrator called me and said, "You need more bandwidth! What do I do?"
Answer, get more bandwidth.
So if you want to check that out, go to restaurantguysradio.com or iTunes, and you can get the old shows, but you and WCTC get to hear them first in the Central Jersey listening area. I don't know if you heard the weatherman right before we came on, Mark, but those of you who are not in the restaurant business don't realize the little our hearts came up into our throat because...
Yeah, snow on Saturday of Valentine's weekend is really a bad thing.
What's wrong with people in Jersey that it snows a little bit and they go out and buy 5 gallons of milk, 4 loaves of bread, and then hunker down in their house? When was the last time you got stuck in your house for a week?
Can I tell you one thing?
What?
One of the things, though?
And who wants that much milk?
Having a family and a really big driveway.
Yeah.
After you're done shoveling the driveway, you want to sit in the chair with a thing of hot cocoa and turn on the TV and put your earmuffs on.
For a week? For a week? I remember I used to work in a supermarket, and the same thing would happen. They'd predict snow, and like we'd love it. People come in, they'd buy milk and bottled water and flashlights and
batteries.
Where do you live, Alaska?
Right.
When was the last time you were snowed in for a week?
Yeah.
I don't know. All right, so the other thing people do is they often cancel reservations at restaurants.
Yeah, that's a very popular thing to do in the snow.
And this is
even in rain sometimes you get a lot of cancellations in restaurants.
And this is Valentine's weekend, everybody. So you're
don't cancel. So you're don't cancel.
You know, there's an old Irish saying.
You got to go out.
There's an old Irish saying about people who would go out and say, "Oh, I don't want to go out. It's raining." They'd say, "Now you're not made of sugar." So, everybody, you're not made of sugar. Go out for dinner on Valentine's Day. You know, speaking of Valentine's Day, we've gotten a lot of questions. We took a number of emails about restaurants that have stricter reservations policies on Valentine's Day.
Or any holiday. Any holiday
menu. And a number of people have emailed us and said, you know, why do restaurants do this? And why do I have to leave a credit card number if I want to make a reservation on Valentine's Day? When, you know, normally you wouldn't have to leave a credit card number.
And we've talked about some of this before is that sometimes you have people who make reservations at multiple places and want to spring on their guests and
their
say,
Valentine,
where do you want to go?
And say, I have 5 reservations,
those
where do you want to go?
Things.
And then you're stuck. And the other thing is, frankly, we're going to turn away 100 people at each of our restaurants on Valentine's Day, and so is everybody else, because they something like 60% of Americans dine out on Valentine's Day or something crazy like that. I read a statistic last week. Now,
and the Saturday before as well.
And the Saturday before is just a holiday, is big a holiday. So we take credit card reservations because, and very often people will try a new place on Valentine's Day, and very often people who go out but twice a year go out on Valentine's Day because they have to. Maybe they don't even want to, but their girlfriend's going to kill them, you know. So, you know, what we have to avoid is if we didn't take reservations, and we didn't take reservations the first Valentine's Day we were open, and we had a 40% no-show rate. I mean, and we turned away 100 people.
But anyway, more importantly than that, people have been asking us things like, well, why do you do tasting menus? Why do you do menus that are different than your everyday menu?
What many restaurants will do on Valentine's Day is have a preset tasting menu for that night at a prefixed price and not have their normal a la carte service. And there's a real reason for that.
Actually, there are a lot of reasons for it. And the first one is so many people call us and say, listen, I'm bringing my spouse out. I'm bringing my girlfriend out. It's a very important night for us. We're going up in caliber of restaurant from where we normally would go in order to stretch because it's a special occasion. And so they're asking us very frequently to do something special.
Like a special tasting
menu. Tasting menus. Frankly, we get so many of those requests on those special nights that it would be impossible to do our regular a la carte menu as well as all of these special
tasting menus.
Tasting
menus for 70% of the people who sit
down.
So
the plan there is to, let's make a tasting menu for everyone. Let's do, so we can, we and the idea is make a special special evening out menu for everyone who comes in.
And the other thing that honestly happens, I mean, we'll be straight up with you here. I mean, a lot of people do go out on Valentine's Day who might not otherwise go out, or people do trade up a little bit from mm-hmm. where they normally go. And again, you're turning away a lot of people for those seats. And what can happen if you go awry is, look, if you're in a no-reservation restaurant, like a Bennigan's or whatever, they make you stand at the bar, and so there's always a line of people ready to take a table as soon as you get up. So if someone comes in and they sit down and they share a house salad and a nice mm-hmm. tea and they leave and they spent, you know, $14, that's fine because they've only been at the table for a few minutes. Somebody else sits down, and they're there longer and they spend more.
And frankly, even on a regular night, a restaurant, and we'll use Captain Lombardi as the restaurant of choice in this
particular
example.
Which is a more casual restaurant.
It's a little bit more casual, and you may have people waiting for tables. In that circumstance, if someone comes into the restaurant and spends 45 minutes or a half an hour, has a salad, maybe has just a pasta, and goes, there's someone waiting for that table. On a day like Valentine's Day, there are no people waiting for those tables.
And so what we have to do when you're all reservations like that is I allot 2.5 hours for mm-hmm. a table for two to have dinner. And
in
so,
order to not rush people out.
Right, because that's the other thing. You
the
want.
Goal there is, this is a special night for you. I take that very, very seriously. I know a lot of people and a lot of restaurant owners who are frustrated by days like Valentine's Day because exactly that. People are trading up in order to go to that special restaurant. I take that just as seriously and sometimes even more seriously. When you're trading up to come to my restaurant, and this may be the nicest restaurant that you ever go to, there's a big responsibility that
Absolutely.
Comes with that. There's a lot of expectation on your part as the diner, and I think there's a lot that's on me to make sure that you have as special, the most special evening. If you're planning on it being the most expensive meal of your life, my hope is that it will also be the most special
meal. Or even
your
most expensive meal of the month. I mm-hmm. mean, it's a large responsibility. Now, but the idea is if I have a reservation and I have reservations set 2.5 hours apart and someone comes in and orders a house salad and they share a pasta and mm-hmm. they spend $19, well, I don't have anybody to put at that table.
Right.
Now, yes, you're there for only half an hour, which is fine, but, you know, the waiter's going to make a living. We got to make a living, and I turned away a bunch of people. So if you put someone on a tasting menu, what you can say mm-hmm. is, listen, tonight is a special night, and because it's Valentine's Day and because that's what most people want, you sort of pick and choose. So to answer the questions in the email about why people do a special menu on a Valentine's Day like that or on a special holiday like that is, you know, when you're that busy, you mm-hmm. need to pick who you're going to please. And if you want to do something special for Valentine's Day, you may need to put some things in place that, you know, if you want to come in for just a light, quick meal, if you want to come in for a business dinner, maybe Valentine's Day is not the right night to go
right.
out, or the Saturday before Valentine's
it's
Day.
It's funny because a lot of times I'll tell my friends, come the day before, come the day after, mm-hmm. the restaurant will be more in its normal mode,
right.
as opposed to catering to
this
all these people
occasion.
Out for Valentine's Day.
Hey, listen, when we come back, we have a very special guest. Eric Asimov is going to join us. He's an author who writes freelance, writes mostly for the New York Times. He's written a couple of books, and he's one of our favorite writers about food and wine, and we look forward to talking to him after the break. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis from Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we have a very special guest today. Eric Asimov is co-author of the New York Times Guide to Restaurants in 2004. He's reviewed many restaurants in the 25 and under column for the Times, where we read him regularly. He's also the chief wine critic there. His book, 25 and Under, A Guide to the Best Inexpensive Restaurants in New York, was invaluable to me through the late 90s. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, happy to be here.
Eric, thanks for being here with us today.
I read your stuff all the times in the Time, and we've never met in person, but you always write about really fabulous stuff.
Thank you.
You write about style, you write about food, you write about wine. I envision you as quite the bon vivant. Is that true?
No, I would hardly describe myself that way. I'm just one of those guys who fades into the woodwork, pretty much.
How do you specialize in the kind of cool stuff that you write about? How does that happen?
I think it's there's a lot of luck involved, definitely, but it's something, it's a subject that I've been fascinated with all of my adult life. Restaurants, eating, cooking, wine, beer, spirits, and I've just, you know, if I weren't doing it professionally, I would be one of those people with a blog right now.
Right.
You know, one of the things I really like, Eric, is how diverse your column is. Whether you're talking about Belgian beers or the wines of Portugal, or you're writing in your 25 under column about some out of the way restaurant that people weren't reading about every day in some other column or newspaper. Really interesting how the diversity there.
How do you decide what to write? I mean, what binds all of your writing together? Because there's sort of a common theme of the subjects that you write to.
Well, I think, first of all, it's a fascination with all aspects. During the time that I did 25 and under, which I stopped doing in 2004, you know, I wanted to vary the kinds of cuisines I was talking about, the price levels of the restaurants, the areas that they were located in. And, you know, you can write about a new trattoria in New York City every week for the next 30 years if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And probably people would be interested in those, mm-hmm. but they get tiresome after a while. And, you know, I think in terms of restaurants, there is no more diverse place than New York City.
For some of our listeners who may not read the Times on a regular basis, there is every Wednesday there is a restaurant review, and for many years there's also which is, you know, sort of a high profile restaurant review, full on restaurant review, and there's always a column that appears just under it called the 25 and under column or $25 and under column, which is for, you know, more modestly priced restaurants. Now,
Eric did the reviews of for years and
for
years
many,
and
years. How did this originate, and how does picking a restaurant for the 25 and under column, how is that criteria different than picking a restaurant for the full-on review?
Well, we started 25 and under in 1992, and at that time I was the editor of the food section at the Times, and we had never really covered inexpensive restaurants in a dedicated way, and so I volunteered myself to do the column, and to my surprise they took me up on it.
Uh-huh.
And I did it for the next 12 years, and you know, there is just so much to choose from. Mm-hmm. The more high profile piece is a little bit more driven by what's opening. There are high profile restaurateurs, very well known famous people who are opening new places, and there's a responsibility there to cover those sorts of places. I think for the 25 and under reviewer, there's just a much wider variety of kinds of places to cover, from you know, restaurants opened by South American or Asian or African immigrants that are really intended just to serve the immigrant community, to neighborhood places, you know, all sorts of things. And
is it when you pick a place, or when you didn't, when you had the 25 and under column, and now, when a restaurant is picked, because I'm always amazed at what gets picked for inclusion in the 25 and under column, because there have to be, you know, a million restaurants that you can pick. What makes a restaurant, is it the story of the restaurant that makes it interesting, or is it the food, or is it that it's an incredible bargain? What gets you into the 25 and under column?
I'll tell you, the honest truth is all of those things that you mentioned are true, but more often than not, desperation plays a role.
the restaurateurs or yours?
And no, the writers, because, you know, you've got to put out a column mm-hmm. every week. And
we understand. We do a daily show.
Right, you know, and unlike the major restaurant where the major review where the critic can be quite comfortable slamming some famous place, there's just no point in slamming most 25
right.
restaurants.
I went to this little trattoria on the corner. It didn't look like much, and it wasn't. Not a very
yeah,
not a good story.
You never heard of this place, and you were better off.
Hey, listen, our guest is Eric Asimov from the New York Times. We're talking about wine and food with him, and we'll be talking more in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125. You know, Mark and I are always saying that long-term, good environmental policy and good economic policy are one and the same. And that's not just for the government, it's also for small business and homeowners just like you. To help us put our money where our mouth is, we called E2ECTA. E2ECTA uses a team of specialists to find practical ways for your business or home to conserve energy and even to generate green energy that the utility company then has to buy back from you. That generates a different kind of green for your bottom line. We've gone solar at our restaurants. We're now producing cheap, non-polluting electricity, and with the help of E2ECTA, we did it for very little money. The government programs available to get you set up are unbelievable. We're talking about grants here, not loans, but grants. E2ECTA will help you find the right programs for you, and they'll do the paperwork. You keep the profits. It's a no-brainer, people. For lower energy usage, more profits for yourself, call E2ECTA at 908-359-9300 or click on their link at restaurantguysradio.com. E2ECTA for total energy solutions.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, the stage left in Kaplan Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Eric Asimov of The New York Times.
Eric, you know, rumor has it that you've turned down the restaurant critic position at the New York Times several times. Is that something that you don't want on your resume, or?
No, that's not true.
Okay.
Okay.
You know, I love what I'm doing right now. I had as the last few years that I was doing 25 and under, I was also starting to write about wine. And to expand that role into writing about wine full time is great. I love it.
Well, you know, it's funny because we have a bunch of friends who are restaurant critics for various publications in New York and New Jersey, and they just go out to dinner all the time. And there's nothing I love as much as going out to dinner. But boy, I mean, but between writing feature articles and reviewing restaurants every week, they are always out to dinner. It's too much.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about the pressure in that exactly that. You need to go out all the time and be reviewing and be constantly focused on that. I mean, that's a big burden on your dining out.
I'll just say one thing about that. You know, all these restaurant critics who want you to know how hard their life is, that's ridiculous. Come on, it's the best job in the world.
But it is.
I just don't want anybody else to know it.
Sorry
for that.
You know what? I have to say, it is a great job, especially if you're going on somebody's dime. But I know a couple of restaurant critics who work on a very limited budget, and actually they don't review for very good publications. And I know some people have reviewed for very good publications and do freelance, but they'll go in on a limited budget, and it seems to me that you're going to a restaurant, you're writing, and you're going to the gym, man, because I'd weigh 400 pounds.
Yeah, that would take, well, I'm
well,
not
you know,
that far away.
I have to say, reviewing restaurants for a place like The Times is really a privilege, because doing it on a limited budget puts an enormous amount of pressure on a critic to get it right immediately. You don't have the luxury to think about it, to go back, to double check. And, you know, I think there's the reviews suffer, and so do the critics when you're in that kind of situation.
Well, one of the things that I've said and seen in reviews and something I like to say all the time is I never like to see a 4-star review, and I never like to see a 1-star review unless that critic's been there quite a few times.
Well, you know, that makes sense, because there's nothing that draws you up short when you've been to some place a couple of times and you've had a great experience and a bad experience.
Right.
What
mm-hmm.
do you say? You
know? And that's not 4 stars. I mean, 4 stars is you get it right and you get it right all the time, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, our guest is Eric Asimov. We're going to be talking with him about wine right after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. And now you can download our podcasts on iTunes.
Today's guest is Eric Asimov. Eric Asimov is the chief wine critic of the New York Times.
Now, Eric, you've totally rearranged the wine column at the Times. When Frank Pryl had it, it was a weekly column that was done by one man. Now you're holding tasting panels and report on a place, a variety of wine that include sometimes differing opinions of those panelists. What prompted the change?
Well, first of all, it's not all that different from when Frank was doing it, but we started the wine panel about, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago now, and the idea was just to get a consistent review of wines in the paper. It's something that we had been doing occasionally, but really hadn't been devoting that much space to. And, you know, it's interesting to see what different people think. In wine, we all tend to think of there being one sort of dictatorial opinion about whether something is good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that's one of the things that Francis and I like the most about the column is that it's not one dictatorial opinion. There are differing views, and sometimes you're saying, I loved it, she hated it.
Yeah, I mean, it's I wouldn't exactly call it a democracy because I get the final word.
Yeah, it's like being on the radio. We have our finger on the button, you know.
Exactly. But you know, but it's nice to know that there's not unanimity about what's good or bad in wine. That's not to say that some people aren't wrong.
Right.
Well, there are a variety of opinions.
I think it's interesting, actually. That raises a larger point, and I think one of the biggest points that people debate about wine now is, I mean, there are a couple of the Wine Spectator and the Wine Advocate who have their 100-point scale, and there are a couple of other publications who rate wine. And there's a lot of reaction against that. I mean, people talk about the Parkerification of wine. And I remember, oh, God, it was you weighed in on the documentary by Jonathan Nossiter back in March called Mondo Vino.
Right.
And, you know, I'm trying to remember. You started the article, what I remember, you said something like, if you want to start a fight, mention Mondo Vino to people in the wine business and take a step back. You want to tell us about that?
Well, you know, did you guys see that movie?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we did. Of course.
It was a really provocative look at the wine world today. And, you know, my position was to have a lot of sympathy with Jonathan's point of view that globalization is stripping away some of the diversity in the wine world and there's a growing uniformity. But he did it in such an antagonistic way that I think he lost a lot of sympathy.
Yeah, he was definitely trying to stir the pot. There's no doubt about that.
It was he'll deny it, but it was a kind of a Michael Moore take where the very people you're trying to appeal to end up antagonized because you've created so much ill will.
Well, you know, it's funny. It was a very pointed documentary. And we had Neil Rosenthal on the show to talk about it, though we never got Nossiter on the show.
Yeah.
I think that movie had a lot of value in that it got people arguing. Just as you said when you started the article, it got people talking about, and for the people in the audience who may not know what it is that we're talking about, there are two opinions on what's going on in the wine world. And as, you know, wine is an all-time high level of consumption, which is a great thing, especially in this country. We have this tremendous awareness about wine. But sometimes as big business takes more and more of a role and big critics take more and more of a role in what we drink and how we drink, individual small producers are fighting to, you know, to keep their individuality. And I think that's a very complex and interesting
issue. Yeah, but we've talked about this, too, in the past. And, I mean, I don't blame Parker for being that single voice. I blame us.
Right, of course.
Well, that's absolutely true. And, you know, I think we have to have some sympathy for Parker. People in the wine business complain all the time about ratings. They expect us to go out and buy all of these wines for enormous sums of money and make up our own minds.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people just don't have money to burn. They need consumer guides like Parker or like other people to help them decide how to spend their money.
True, but I think it's a lot more interesting for the weekly column in the Times where you have a couple of different opinions. And I think as people mature and as we mature as a wine country and people realize there's not an opinion, there are mm-hmm. several opinions out there.
Not only are there several opinions, but there are different ways to drink wine. I think too often in our country we are trained to approach it as connoisseurs.
Right.
That's why we get we end up looking only for those 95 point mm-hmm. wines. We want something that's great, and too often the good is sacrificed for the great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at your dinner table every night, you want a good wine that complements the food. You don't want some sort of superstar.
I mean, right.
It doesn't go.
I think that sometimes what we do is we think about 100 point wine instead of thinking about, well, I'm having pizza. Because a 100 point Cabernet Sauvignon
and
is not a 100 point wine when you eat it with pizza.
Right. When you drink it with pizza.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think that that's the difference that you see in cultures where you grow up drinking wine. You don't take it so seriously. You have a special wine on a special occasion, but you have good, enjoyable wines as a matter of course. And I find that there's just not enough good, enjoyable wines made, especially in the United States, because nobody wants to make good wine. They only want to make the greatest wine.
Right, which is like...
And what? So you end up with a lot of bad, ambitious wine.
Now,
I think you go back to that point scale then, because a lot of people are...
Looking for the points.
Trying to get big points.
Because they sell. Hey, listen, the wine column this week talked about one of our favorite regions and varietals. You talked about Malbec.
Yes.
How do you come about picking a topic like that? And then how do you decide what wines you're going to review?
Well, it's a little bit like restaurants. You know, there's so much diversity in the wine world that I don't want to just review Cabernets week after week or just review French wine. So I'm trying to go all over. And once we pick a category, we go out into the marketplace and just try to collect wines. We have a coordinator for the tasting because we taste blind, so I don't want to know what we're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And he just accumulates stuff.
And so he goes out to liquor stores and buys?
We're sort of bound by what we can find in the stores.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's also pretty relevant because you're reviewing about what people can then go out
sure,
and buy in the
you're
stores.
Sure, right. Exactly. You're reviewing what people can purchase.
So is
although I don't get I get so many emails from people who said, oh, you love that wine and we can't find it anywhere.
You know what's funny?
You know, basically all they've done is gone down to the corner.
Right, right.
And they only want that particular wine. I try not to get into the trap of recommended specific labels and specific years. I'm trying to write more about the category.
Mm-hmm.
Malbec, Beaujolais, or whatever, and get people to explore that for themselves and give them some suggestions. But, it's strange. People want to know exactly what to get, just the way when you review a restaurant, they only want to order the dish that you like.
You know, it's funny, being in the restaurant business, when we got reviewed from the Times in our first restaurant, I remember we got reviewed in August, right? And people would show up in December with the Times review from August and order the gazpacho. Why don't you have the gazpacho? Because it's December.
I actually remember the line was I drive the 35 miles again for the whatever dish, but the whatever dish was seasonal.
Right, but you got to drive that in August.
Yeah.
So I tell you, we looked at your article this Wednesday about Argentine Malbec, and it's funny because
right.
we often say, oh, they missed the Paul House Cobos, you know, or mm-hmm. you know.
I did miss that one,
yeah,
I think.
Did you didn't have that one? That wasn't in
no,
this
we
week's.
No, we couldn't find it.
Oh, spectacular. There's a great little restaurant in Central Jersey that has three vintages of it.
You should make a trip out. We have a vertical. our guest today is Eric Asimov. He's the chief wine critic of the New York Times. We're going to be talking more with him about wine and food in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Eric Asimov, Chief Wine Critic of the New York Times. Eric, we were talking before about wine mostly made from grapes, but I've looked to you for the last 10 years or so for kind of what's coming next and where things are moving, and I think a lot of people look to the Times for that. You've written about sake, and I think one of the interesting things about sake is not sake in and of itself, but although that is very interesting, but I remember about, I don't know, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, I went down to Chanterelle to visit Roger DeGorn, who's the sommelier down there.
Right.
And he had a sake section on his wine list at this French restaurant. Is that a new trend that you see, and is that a trend that you welcome, sake being served in Western European restaurants?
Well, you know, it's been going on now for a few years, and I think it's great. It's not so much in the European restaurants, but in New York anyway, we've got more and more Asian restaurants, mm-hmm. Japanese in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And not just sushi restaurants either, but of all sorts. And you know, they at first were a little bit reluctant to be serving sake, but it has caught on, partly with the help of people like Roger DeGorn at Chanterelle. And I think it's a great thing. Sake is such a nuanced, subtle beverage that there's just a lot there to learn about and to be satisfied by.
Well, that's one of the things we were talking about earlier, is matching the right food with the right wine, and whether it's a rice wine or a grape wine.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that what I find really interesting about that is when you go to an American restaurant or a French restaurant and they have one or two really well-chosen sakes that the sommelier pulls out almost like a magic mm-hmm. trick, and I'm thinking to myself, I got to learn about this now too.
Well, you know, there's a lot of fusion, to use a somewhat hackneyed term, mm-hmm. but you know, how many European restaurants do you go to and they have something called crudo, or
right.
you know, they're marinated raw sliced fish or different kinds of Asian spices. So, you know, it's all to the good.
Well, now, you also have written about, you write instead of your wine column is called Wine of the Times, but you also occasionally will see the Ales of the Times.
Yeah.
You've written about Belgian Ales.
I do love that you mix that up.
Well, you know, I love beer, and I mm-hmm. think that there's this enormous audience for beer that it's almost completely unrecognized.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of anybody else that is really doing it, any other sort of mass publication, but the response I get when we do one of those Ales of the Times articles is just enormous.
You know,
and all you have to do is go to the local deli and see all the microbrew beers that are available.
Okay, you can go to your local bowling alley and grab a Trappist ale.
You know, the funny thing is, I mean, this is the top of the line. These are the best beers in the world.
Right.
And you can get them anywhere for an affordable price. You can't do that with wine.
Well, I see the difference even in 1992, or actually in the late 80s, when Chimay was like the only Belgian beer or kind of a handcrafted beer you could find. And now they're everywhere. And now we even have the American subgeneration of those styles of beers, and the Canadian, of course.
Yeah, and you know it's a fascinating study to look at these microbrewers who are just fed up with this sort of industrialization of the brewing world, and you know they had vision and passion, mm-hmm. and they created a market for all of these old styles of beer that had basically disappeared in this country.
You know, you wrote about Belgian ales a while back, and I thought
right.
that was a great article because Mark and I have been fans for a long time. And we were actually excited in one of the Michael Jackson books. We used to carry more Belgian ales than we do. And we found we were aging Belgian ales for a mm-hmm. while. And, you know, one of the things that's amazing is if you're a beer fan, and Belgian ales is a lot like wine, you can have, like, an aged bottle of some of the best beer in the world and like, the best, and it's, like, mm-hmm. $20, you know?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
You know? And if you want, like, some of the best wine in the world, it's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of dollars. How did you come across? You wrote an article about a guy named Josko Grovener who
yes.
ages wines in amphoras coated in beeswax.
Right.
How the heck? Now, I read that article. We now carry Grovener wines based on that review. And actually, we then did a show on it, and Andre Mack, the head sommelier at Per Se, uh-huh. heard our show and then came to our restaurant based on that because he carries it too. But I found out about it through you. How do you find out about stuff like that?
Well, you know, it's if you're a reporter, you talk to a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I talk to people who are in the Italian wine world, and Grovener is not a new face. He's been making great wine for years, and the strange thing about him is that he keeps changing what he's doing. He makes great wines in a certain style, and then he renounces it. And, you know, so I was aware of him, and then, you know, somebody told me, oh, he's not making that great 1998 Breg that he made. He's not making wines in that style anymore. He's buried amphora in the ground.
Now he's burying 3,500-liter amphora in the ground.
Right. So I just thought it was fascinating. And if you go to that region of the world, Friuli, Giulia Venezia, you've got this little a pocket of idiosyncratic winemakers who just do things. They're just rebels. They're contrarians. They do things their own way, and they make fantastic wines.
Well,
they're not mass market wines because you can't make them in quantity. But if you get a chance to taste them, they're just wonderful.
The world owes you a debt of gratitude for bringing that so that we could know a little bit about it. Our guest again is Eric Asimov of the New York Times. We're talking with him about wine and food, where he's the chief wine critic of the New York Times. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest today is Eric Asimov, the chief wine critic for the New York Times. Now, Eric, you've been editor of the Living section, right?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
You were editor of the Living section and the Style section at one point in the past,
yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
And you're also the chief wine critic, and you've reviewed restaurants for the Times.
Yeah.
Do you travel a lot? I mean, does your wine writing take you to wine regions like Friuli, Venezia, or to Argentina for Malbec, or do you write mostly from New York?
Well, yeah. You know, when I was reviewing restaurants, it was hard to get away because, you know, you're kind of on an enforced schedule going out.
We understand.
Yeah.
But since I've been writing about wine full time, so I've gotten to travel a lot more.
What's the most interesting place that your wine writing has taken you, do you think? What's the place that people don't know about that they need to know about?
Friuli was a great place in its neighboring province of the neighboring country of Slovenia, where great and unrecognized wines are coming from.
Right.
A Campania in southern Italy is a source of really good value red wines made from the Aglianico grape. I think the Loire Valley is another really unrecognized source of great food wines, whether from Cabernet Franc like Chinon and Bourgogne, or Sauvignon Blanc or Chenin Blanc, like Vouvray and Sauvignier.
Chenin Blanc is probably one of our favorite white grapes.
Hey,
thanks to Rebola.
Listen, Eric, we want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk with us. This has been a great conversation. We love you.
My pleasure, Mark.
Thanks very
Take
much.
Take care.
Eric.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
That was Eric Asimov. He has written a lot of things for the New York Times. He has in the past been editor of the Style section, the Living section. He's been he's written restaurant reviews. He wrote the 25 and Under restaurant review for a long time. And he's currently the chief wine critic for the Times. And you can read his column every Wednesday in the New York Times. And you can pick that up, of course, across the country. It's the
paper
record. We do.
We really do. We read it every week.
And we'll put up some links to some of the regions that Eric was talking about on our website. And we'll link it. We'll also recommend a good wine from Slovenia, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Ola Giala from Slovenia. We'll tell you about Josko Grosvenor as well. Hope you've enjoyed the hour. This is Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.
This is your place for Central Jersey news.